Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:27 p.m. and then that is Central Time. Today is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought I would kick off with the Fangman Index because we've had a lot of volatility in the stock market today, and I think it's also central to the longer-term themes because it's been a clear secular bull market for mega caps. And over the course of the last decade, we've been in an environment where interest rates have been especially low. There have been lots of different areas which have had negative real interest rates and indeed negative yielding bonds. And it was well understood when that condition first emerged in 2014 that this wasn't something that was sustainable. But I don't think anybody was predicting that it was going to last quite as long as it has, but we are rapidly now coming out of that situation, and there are certainly, I think, important considerations to pay attention to. But we'll get to those in a moment. In the meantime, if we look at the eight shares that comprise the Fangman Index, then they have outperformed the market by a really considerable margin, and I think we can clearly see on this chart that there's been both a clear acceleration from the lows in 2020 through to the peak in late 2021, and subsequently a major loss of consistency. So we had the acceleration, which in itself is a trend-ending characteristic, a loss of momentum, a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, then a sharp rebound and a reversal. And now a drop down to new reaction lows. This is a downtrend. And the bigger question then is how much lower is it going to go? Well, if we then think about the Fangman companies relative to the total market, well, then what we have here is another interesting development because it has been largely range bound for nearly 2 years. So, despite the fact that the Fangman shares did especially well during the pandemic, the rest of the market picked up pace and, in fact, kept pace with the advance in the Fangman shares all the way through 2021. Then, in the latter portion of the year, they re-upped and the Fangman shares outperformed for a while and even were able to push on to a new all-time high and a record level of over 23% for eight shares for the relative to the entire capitalization of the US markets. So, this isn't simply looking at the S&P 500 or even the Wilshire 5000, it's the entire market cap. And now it's starting to come back down. We can clearly see that this is a bigger range and that we're seeing clear deterioration. So it is looking increasingly likely, therefore, that the eight largest companies are going to tech companies are going to start rolling over. And of course, they're uniquely sensitive to interest rates. Now, I am doing a re I'm posting a review in Comment of the Day today of the eight large companies from a point and figure perspective. Now, these are 20-year charts, and I'm just looking at daily data. And we can see that Microsoft, for example, did exceptionally well, and we had a series of ranges, one above another. And this persisted all the way through until quite recently. Now, there were occasions when it dipped mildly into the underlying range, but it would never have triggered a midpoint danger line stop. But it did that. We had both it pulling back into the underlying range, triggering the midpoint danger line stop, then rebounding, and now breaking down to another new reaction low. So this is a very clear break of trend. And it suggests that we are now in a bear market. And until we see clear evidence of support building and the ability to sustain rallies, and most particularly a break in the sequence of lower rally highs, well, we would have to conclude that we are in a bear market. Now, it's, I think, also rather interesting to compare everything else to Apple. because Apple is the one share that is still trending in a reasonably consistent manner. It's still holding the range. Now we have a lower high and we have a bigger range. Now there have been occasions in the past where it has pulled back by the same magnitude in terms of units of scale. So until Apple in fact pulls back into the underlying range and breaks a midpoint danger line stop, it's still a reasonably consistent trend. Unfortunately, it's the only one of the eight Fangman plus Tesla shares that are still trending higher in a consistent manner. So Alphabet, having held quite steady over the course of the last 6 months, has now also broken down and completed a top formation. We can then also think about Amazon. So Amazon has obviously been a really incredible success story, but it had this broadening pattern, failed upside breaks, massive reaction against the prevailing trend, then a range below the previous range, and then breaking down. So this is a completing type 2 top formation. Now, we can just look at all of these because obviously some have been pulling back for a while. Netflix has got a clear crash type pattern where it wasn't able to sustain the initial breakout. Facebook had a really impressive day on the upside yesterday, and that did not really do much to break the downtrend. So, but it's had an already and a very pronounced decline. So maybe this is the beginning of some support building activity. But considering the scale of the pullback, then it's quite likely that we're going to see a prolonged period of ranging in order to build some support. So, as we look at these shares, Tesla is obviously going to be one that many people are paying attention to. And of course, Elon Musk has been selling some of his position and will be using some of that money to fund his acquisition of Twitter. But importantly, the share has now got another lower high and it's pulling back down towards the lows. And it really does need to hold that region around the $800 area. But it's an awfully big question whether it will in fact be able to do that. So these kinds of companies have done exceptionally well because they benefited first from low interest rates. And then they had the confluence of positive factors like the release of 4G. And they were ideally placed to pick up the network effects and the clear boost to profitability from 4G. Then we've had the pandemic and the massive swell of additional liquidity and demand for at-home solutions. And that helped to support the price as well. So we have then Nvidia having done exceptionally well in 2020 and 2021, breaking up out of an exceptionally volatile range and surging to unanticipated highs from the perspective of most investors. Now it is breaking back down again. So we can think very clearly, not simply about the large companies, but also then about the cloud computing sector. So it was still looking like a recovery candidate all the way through until the failed upside break at the end of last year. And now it has clearly broken down from that range, broken through the underlying range, and testing the lows once more. So this is not a happy looking chart. We see an increasingly large number of these types of charts where we had the really impressive rally in 2021 and are in 2020, a loss of momentum at the end of 2021, failed upside breaks, massive reactions against the prevailing trend and then breaking lower in here this week. So we're seeing a lot of pressure coming to bear on Wall Street. And today in particular, we saw that everything went down, or at least almost everything went down. So the S&P 500 had also rallied impressively and had little ranges one above the other, and that ended in March. So we had a deeper pullback. It broke the sequence of higher reaction lows. We've had a period of right-hand extension in the region of the 200-day moving average, but most particularly below the overhead range. And now it is breaking lower. I've been using the 1,000-day moving average now for the last few months because I think it is quite relevant in terms of measuring the outlook for the secular bull market. I think it is also going to be coincidental that the 1,000-day moving average now pretty much coincides with the peak from before the pandemic. And I think that that makes sense, or at least it makes sense to me, that we had a tightening monetary and fiscal environment coming through the pandemic. Then we had, or coming up to the pandemic, then we had the pandemic, and we had money printing on a scale that was previously unimaginable, and that stoked inflationary pressures and created probably more problems than it solved. Now we have central banks that are panicking, and they're trying to pull liquidity out of the market, trying to unwind some of the inflationary pressures. You're already starting to see workmen talking about the fact that buying washers in, I've seen pictures online of people using pennies as washers in home improvements because it's cheaper to use washers than it is to buy, or it's cheaper to use pennies than to use washers bought from home appliance stores or home supply stores. So inflationary pressures are definitely front and center, and people are reacting as expected. They're front loading purchases. They are using the credit that's available to their the best of their ability to ensure that they get what they want in a timely manner, and then they're cancelling orders. Then we're also starting to see that people are front-loading physical purchases because they don't want to have cash in their pockets. They're looking for investments that might be able to hold out versus inflation. And these are all exceptionally difficult questions. But the reality here is that we have what is increasingly looking like a medium-term correction that has further to go on the downside. And if we go back and think then, well, if the massive amount of liquidity printed in order to save the global economy created inflation, well, perhaps taking it back out will kill off inflation. And I then think that if we're thinking about where downward targets should be, well, then perhaps we should be looking at the highs from 2019, early 2020, or the 1,000-day moving average. And they pretty much coincide with one another right now. Now, there have been occasions when the S&P 500 has traded below the 1,000-day moving average. And it's quite likely that we're going to be presented with another one. And then the bigger question will be, will the Federal Reserve relent? Will they decide then that we've had enough of asset price correction? And is it time then to make money more easily available? But we certainly know that when the ECB tried to reduce the size of their balance sheet, and they took €1 trillion out of circulation, well, they created deflation. And there was a really significant deflationary scare in the Eurozone between 2014 and 2015. And then the Federal Reserve, they took two, or they took 750 billion out of circulation, and there were deflationary fears in 2019 as well. So the Federal Reserve has obviously learned that lesson. They're talking about accelerating the pace of quantitative easing. They took 40 billion out of circulation a month between 2018 and the third quarter of 2019. Now they're talking about doubling that. So that is going to have a swift knock-on effect. It's going to suck liquidity out of the market. And it is, of course, also helping to support the US dollar. So as the US dollar rises, now it was in mildly negative territory today, and it is overbought in the short term. So we could easily see some consolidation here. But the Federal Reserve is withdrawing liquidity from the size of the balance sheet. That is reducing the number of dollars in circulation, which is going to help to support the currency. Now, the only other country that's really starting to talk about reducing the size of their balance sheet is the UK. But they're going to do it in a much slower manner. Now, when we think about the kinds of days like we've had today, where both bonds and equities sold off, this is really deleterious to the outlook for the 60/40 portfolio. And the vast majority of investors are stuck into that kind of portfolio when they go to an asset manager. The one thing that asset managers try to do is to preserve themselves against the potential for litigation. So they're going to suggest that investors put their money in bonds and equities in a balanced and diversified manner. And by doing so, they can get reasonable returns and the asset manager avoids being sued. So that means there's a lot of people are in bonds and they're losing money right now. And stock markets are pulling back. But then we also have, and this is normal in an environment where we're seeing the supply of dollars deteriorating and the end of quantitative easing. So then we have the additional difficulties that are very much hinging on Russia's invasion of Ukraine amid an environment where commodity prices have already been well bid. Now, we're already also starting to see much more in the way of volatility in the political sphere internationally, and high agriculture prices are the kind of thing that can create difficulties for the global community. But despite the fact that we are in an environment where there's pressure on supply, prices are starting to come back down. So wheat was in negative territory in here today. Oil prices were in mildly positive territory and continue to bounce from the $100 area. But there's been a clear sequence of lower rally highs over the last 2 months, and it would at least need to break that in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment beyond the short term. Natural gas prices have been up one day, down the next, and they were up on Wednesday, down yesterday, recouped almost all of that loss in here today. So this is still holding here around the $7 area, and it's a reasonably well-defined range, and it suggests that we can prepare for higher prices as the summer goes on. And there's going to be a lot of volatility because Russia doesn't look like it's going anywhere. And they are going to likely be subject to European sanctions for the lengthy medium term. So they're going to try and put pressure on commodity prices. And by cutting off Poland and Bulgaria from Russian exports, that's certainly at least part of the reason why, or one of the reasons why we should anticipate that there's going to be more volatility. But it also begs the bigger question: what exactly is Russia trying to do? So, the Russian ruble isn't updated by Bloomberg any longer. And it hasn't been updated since the 10th of March, when it was right on its lows. But it has now appreciated past the highs that were posted ahead of the invasion. So Russia's currency has certainly improved, and the domestic stock market, which is dollar denominated, the RTSI, is bouncing. So it has rebounded rather impressively from the $600 area, and it's now up to over 1,000. Now, I think it would be very rash to expect that it's going to go straight up, but it's certainly not going down. And it's exhibiting more stability than a good many other markets. And of course, the one thing that we know about the Russian stock market today is that there are no ETFs. And there are a lot of ETFs in the Fangman shares. And there are probably legions of people who own stock market indices and think that they are being preserved from individual stock risk. But the reality is that when eight shares represent over 20% of the total market, well, it means pretty much everybody owns them. And they're just about all going down. So this certainly has potential for contagion out of the broad ETF universe. So it's likely then that the kinds of shares that are going to do well are going to be those that aren't really very well represented in the ETF sector. And then there are going to be lots of companies with strong cash flows that are going to get sold off in a contagion manner. And there is plenty of evidence of contagion. When we think about the energy sector, oil prices, they might be rangy, but they're not falling. And ExxonMobil was in negative territory today, despite the fact that it more than doubled its stock buyback, it's increasing its dividend, and it's reporting record earnings. And the share continues to struggle to continue to push higher. Chevron had initially popped higher, and then that was following earnings, and then pulled back rather sharply in here today. So we're getting at least some consolidation in here. Shell has also been rallying, but it was in negative territory in here today. So what this is suggesting is that despite the fact these companies have got the strong cash flows and the rising dividends that should be attractive to investors and the blue chip characteristics that people prize during periods of uncertainty, they're not attracting quite the same interest because we're seeing more contagion selling and people are worried about the outlook for oil. But these companies do represent a potential hedge, and its energy's an under-owned sector. So then Devon Energy, with its clear concentration on natural gas, was firming from the region of the sequence of higher reaction lows, but it was also still in negative territory today. And I think this is also interesting. Gold prices were up almost $20 at one point in here today and then failed to sustain the entire move. So we're definitely seeing evidence in here of a flight to cash because investors are loath to pour money into bonds. In normal circumstances, investors would be selling equities and buying bonds, but they're not buying bonds right now. The 10-year yield was higher in here today. Now, with selling pressure persisting in the long end of the curve, then money is going to have to find a home somewhere. So, 3-month yields were in positive territory, but are still very much range bound, although I do think that this trend is going to continue to move higher. So, where can people put their money? Because everything appears to be going down. Bitcoin prices were down $1,000 today. Now, they've been very range bound and haven't been subject to the same kind of volatility as some of the exceptionally large cap equities. But Bitcoin's not going up either. And there's a lot of enthusiasm within the crypto sector about Ethereum as the proof of work stake starts to come to fruition. But the price is also pulling back and has a much more similar pattern overall to Bitcoin. Therefore, investors are simply raising cash. And then there's going to be a buying opportunity set up here. And perhaps China offers an example of what that might look like. So, Tencent is beginning to offer some support. And it was potentially putting in a higher reaction, though, in here today and bouncing in an emphatic fashion. So that's certainly beneficial for sentiment. But we've already had a really deep and significant pullback. It's also, I think, particularly notable that when we look at the Nasdaq, it was the Chinese tech companies were the leading advancers. Now, in the 102 shares on the index, there were only seven of them were in positive territory, and the top four were all Chinese tech companies. So this gives us a clue to what helps to support the sector. Liquidity does. And the Fangman shares have been the clearest beneficiaries of liquidity. China has got significant issues. Now, when we think about the world debt map, then we're, I think, presented with rather interesting information. So, if we instead of looking at sectors, we look at the regional data, then we can see that the debt in North America and the Pacific Rim is reasonably similar. When we think then about where's all this debt coming from and the spending that it represents and how much it's going to represent in terms of dealing with the debt servicing costs, this is an awfully big question. And a stronger currency certainly helps with that, and because it reduces the cost of imports. Now, China has got an issue in that the USA has about 35 trillion in total debt. And when we look at the constituents of that, the majority of it is in US treasuries and notes. But then there's lots in the corporate sector. So the corporate sector is largely independent of the US government, and we could have a healthy argument about how much of it would in fact be bailed out by the government in extremis. But then we should think about the Pacific Rim, because China has got about 20 trillion of that in debt, and the USA has about 20 to 25 trillion in terms of government debt, and China's government debt is only about 3.4 trillion. But then the development bank is 1.6, so it's already 5 trillion. And then Agriculture Bank, the Export Import Bank, the province of Jiangsu, Guangdong, the railway group, Shandong, Zhejiang. So all of these represent hundreds of billions of dollars in debt. And it stretches from government agencies, the development banks, to regional governments, and then just regular banks, and all of these are arms of the government. So when you start adding it all together, well, then the big difference between China and the USA is that the vast majority of Chinese debt has got an implicit, if not explicit, backing from the government, whereas that's Again, we could argue that it's equally true in the USA because of the willingness of the government to wade in and bail out non-systemically important portions of the economy. So the rescuing of GM, for example, is a good example of that. It was about political calculus rather than specifically whether General Motors is absolutely essential to the US economy. But the linkages between the government and these entities in China is much tighter. So it's said that generals are always fighting the last war. And this is true of everywhere. So in the USA, they printed a ton of money and gave it to the banks after the credit crisis. And then they had to deal with the fact that it created imbalances in the economy. It created this massive divergence between the wealthy and the poor. It seeded political populism on both the left and the right, contributed to a really toxic environment in terms of the political polarization. And when they were then presented with the issues, and of course, the other big point about focusing liquidity on the banking sector was that there wasn't the same trickle-down effect. So we did not have inflation, we didn't have wage demand growth. Instead, what we had was asset price inflation, which only made the problems worse. So the Federal Reserve, on this occasion, decided that they were going to just aim directly at consumers and provide them with the necessary liquidity. And now they have the inflationary issue, but they also have wage demand growth, which is one of the primary things they wanted with the initial quantitative easing program. So that also represented a massive infusion of liquidity. This seems to be very similar to the kinds of lessons that had to be learned and relearned during the 1970s, because in the 1960s we had a period of phenomenal social upheaval and protest movements and popular protest movements, both against the war in Vietnam. Then we had incredible political volatility with several high-profile politicians being assassinated in both the conventional government and protest movements. And in response to the fear, then governments started printing money. So this monetization of debt became a central theme in most countries, or at least most OECD countries in the 1970s. I'll never forget, my mother was always very bitter growing up about how inflation had robbed them in the 1970s and saddled the Irish people with a huge amount of debt that took years to work off. And I think that we're now moving into a similar type of situation. We've learned lessons from the most recent history, and we're falling into the same mistakes that were made in the early 1970s, which then contributed to the inflationary problem. Now we can think about what about China? Well, China also wants to learn from its mistakes. So they were growing healthily, and it was one of the biggest infrastructure booms in history, which was the industrialization of China in about a decade. Then, during the credit crisis, China printed an extraordinary sum of money at the time, made a great deal of it available to the property sector and the corporate sector, and really spurred economic growth as demand from the rest of the world petered out. And That sowed the seeds for a debt-fueled boom over the last decade. So when they were posed with the pandemic and the massive amount of liquidity that other countries were making available, they decided that they weren't going to do that. And instead, they would try and adopt more reform agendas from their perspective, clamping down on the tech sector, making less liquidity available and trying to stamp out leverage in the property market are basically this two parts of the same problem. Then clamping down on the for-profit tutoring sector was an additional challenge for them that they set themselves. And all of it was aimed at improving social cohesion and, most particularly, reorienting the available resources to strategic plays that would further the aim of China to become a global economic, military, and technological superpower. So that's what they've tried to do. Now, what they're being posed with is they're not immune from the pandemic. But China also has made some very clear strategic decisions. They focused their vaccination program on younger people, and they haven't vaccinated the elderly portion of the population to nearly the same extent. It's only at about a 55% vaccination rate, and that is assuming that the Chinese domestic vaccines are effective. I've been characterizing COVID as a euthanasia virus for most of the last 3 years, and China's policy is going to further that definition, because if they're not inoculating elderly people, then this is basically social engineering, and it's going to shorten the or it's going to increase the mortality rate for elderly people. And of course, one of the biggest challenges they have is the dependency ratio. So knocking out a slug of the elderly population is likely to be deemed as a positive outcome for the economy. But they are still wedded to the COVID zero. And one of the biggest challenges for any kind of despotic regime is that they can't ever be seen to be wrong. And the just living with COVID and putting up with a chronic number of infections over time isn't viewed as something that can be done with a large population. But of course, India achieved that. But of course, India also has a younger population. And if we just simply let people get the virus, there will be repercussions. There will be a higher mortality rate. There will be people that have long COVID. There will be difficulties with dealing with the disease. But then there are the vast, vast majority of people who have absolutely no ill effects at all. So it's very much a political decision which way countries go. And with Xi Jinping trying to achieve what no one since Mao has been able to, which is leadership for life, then they're not going to abandon their program of trying to deal with COVID. But you can't weigh on the property market, lock people at home, and expect the economy to continue to thrive. So China has to begin stimulus, and they're starting to devalue the currency. And this opens up a whole number of questions. So they've devalued the currency rather abruptly for 2 weeks, and it's now pausing in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, China doesn't want the currency to trend lower in a rapid manner, but they do want it to depreciate because they need something to help to support the economy and provide additional liquidity. And you can't get everything, so they're trying to then are they going to allow the renminbi to depreciate? Now, we're starting to see some evidence that the tech sector is responding to this supply of additional liquidity. And the China technology ETF bounced very emphatically in late March or February, came all the way back down to test the low, and is now starting to steady again. Now, there's been a profound downtrend, and it hasn't quite yet rallied enough to break that downtrend, but there is at least evidence of support building following a very deep decline. And China's tech companies are not nearly as overvalued as Western ones because of the scale of the decline. But it's all down to liquidity. So, if we're then looking for what is likely in terms of the underperformance of those large cap companies, well, it would be reasonable to anticipate that when central banks decide that enough is enough, that they've raised rates and reduced the size of their balance sheet sufficiently and declare victory over inflation, then the growth sector will rebound. Now, I think it is likely we're going to continue to see downward pressure. I've been also saying this week that I think that it is also likely that we're going to get a bounce heading into or in the immediate aftermath of the first interest rate hike, because we've already seen an awful lot of selling pressure into that event. But then, if this is a rerun of the 1970s, what we should anticipate is short, sharp bull markets, and then short, sharp, deep, worrying bear markets that then quickly reverse. And if that's the case, we should then be looking to buy dips, but not buying the small dip, but buy the big dip. And then when prices rally really impressively, be willing to take profits. We're less likely to see big secular trends in technology. And when we think about the S&P 500 and just look at it on a log scale chart, we've had a really big advance. It is really only just beginning to pull back, and it has plenty of room in which to consolidate. It could easily come back into the region of the pre-pandemic highs and still be in a broad uptrend overall. But that would represent a pullback of another 900 points from where we are right now. And that would turn into a really sizable pullback. The proximity of the 5,000 level as well at the end of last year was an example of roundophobia. So we're still in a corrective phase. The continued ability of the market to continue to trend higher in a secular fashion is going to be very much finely tuned to the provision of liquidity. Now let's think about Russia. So Russia might be thinking about how they have learned from their mistakes in the past. From Russia's perspective, capitalist reforms were a mistake. And Vladimir Putin basically took over after those capitalist reforms failed and has been attempting to reinstitute the USSR since. And invading Ukraine is a big part of that. Then they're also looking at the petrodollar system and they're thinking about, well, why do we have to accept dollars? Wouldn't we be better off just accepting rubles and managing the economy on that basis? So that would internationalize their currency. It would certainly help to create an environment where they're not dependent on the US dollar. what I find particularly interesting is that the ruble and the dollar are the two strongest currencies in the world at present. The euro, the yen, the pound have all been trending downwards. Both the ruble and the dollar have been really very firm. And one, we've been accustomed to competitive currency devaluation. One has to then question whether what we're seeing today between the USA and Russia is competitive currency at appreciation, that the determination of Russia to demand dollars for their oil and their commodity exports, and creating deals with China that China will be a major offtake for their exports and may then pay them in rubles or renminbi, and that they will set up a payment system between the two areas that's primarily aimed at destroying demand for US treasuries. The USA has got massive unfunded liabilities, exceptionally low interest rates, and no real plan for how to pay back those debts. So there's going to have to be some sort of fiscal consolidation, and there's no real appetite for that. And again, this is very similar to what we saw in the 1970s, because people were not really willing to make the sacrifices necessary to get the government finances back on track. And there were, and I think the issue today is that it's much more intense. So the Federal Reserve is seems to be quite intent to raise rates and withdraw liquidity from the balance sheet. And they don't seem to be all that worried about the fact that it leads to deflation because it's helping to support the currency. And the strength of the dollar in a period of exceptional volatility certainly helps to support the view that it is the reserve currency. Now, of course, Russia wants to have the reserve currency. They want to be the major commodity exporter and have all of their exports priced in rubles. Now, Vladimir Putin is talking about backing the ruble with gold or a basket of currencies, of commodities. And then we have the central banker very clearly stating that they are not considering that outcome. But if Putin is discussing it, then they clearly are considering it. And then, of course, if we start to see one currency that is backed by gold or a basket of currencies, or they simply turn Russia into a major commodity currency region, well, then that's going to put significant upward pressure on their currency. If they have to back the dollar or back their renminbi with gold, then that's going to represent a significant headwind for everyone else to buy some, and a massive tailwind for the price. Now, gold prices are steadying in the region of the 200-day moving average. I've been clear that I believe this is a consolidation, and it's been jolly volatile, but it continues to look like consolidation in the region of the all-time peak. So these, I think, are some of the more interesting questions that we have over the lengthy medium term. The fact that Russia has cut off natural gas to Poland and Bulgaria is an escalation of these threats. The fact that China is describing its relationship with Russia as a model for the international community, well, then that's additional saber rattling. We're, I think, seeing a major reorientation of globalization. Now, some people are saying, well, they don't believe that globalization is over. But what we certainly have evidence of is that lots of CEOs in North America are planning on opening factories in Mexico. So they are bringing back factories, and they're not bringing them home, but they're bringing them close to home. So we're getting nearshoring. Now, that might still be viewed as globalization, but it's probably more like regionalization. And that is, I think, more than likely going to be the scenario. So Mexico could be a significant beneficiary of the nearshoring trend. Then Vietnam had pulled back rather sharply last week and was well off its lows in here this week. But that's also a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. So it's got work to do if this is the extent of the pullback. When we think about the Nifty index in India, it's been really very steady. And the renminbi, excuse me, the rupee has been also quite steady. So India is certainly another beneficiary. And if the world is looking for a large young population to work in factories, well, India would certainly fit that bill. It's likely to be a net beneficiary. And not least because it will also be sitting very squarely between an openness for trade with Russia, as well as an openness to oppose China in the region, as well as an openness to accept inward flows from the rest of the world as a bulwark against Chinese expansion in Asia. So India comes out ahead on all fronts, provided it's allowed to tread its own path. When we think then about how all of this figures for the UK, well, the FTSE 250 is right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And considering the weakness that we saw today on Wall Street, it is quite possible, I think even likely, that we're going to have a significant pullback in Europe on Monday. European indices have room in which to consolidate. But the problem here is that we're still in a corrective phase. We're still in an environment where total debt loads have increased. Inflationary pressures are crimping standards of living. Wages have not quite caught up. And in fact, wages are negative in the majority of places. So I thought this was a really interesting graphic that I saw earlier on this week. And it highlights the annual percentage change in wages adjusted for CPI. And they're negative in the USA and in Canada, but they're even more negative in the UK and Europe. Now, rising interest rates also have significant knock-on effects for the ability to fund debt. And that's particularly true for floating rate mortgages. And this is also an additional pass-through for inflation. So we're seeing living standards decline in places like the UK and in Canada, less so in Australia, or perhaps even less so in Canada because of the commodity exports. But we're definitely going to have to see a significant reorientation of economies. And the willingness to commit to green technology is very much tied to political imperatives rather than realpolitik. Everything that can be done to avoid trade with places like Russia or other despotic regimes need to be pursued. And that means that we're likely to have a great deal of volatility in the energy sector. Meanwhile, we have companies like Samsung and Doosan Enerbility building modular reactors for a number of different customers. And the first of those could go into service within the next 4 years. So that is also likely to contribute to more interest in the uranium sector. And California is talking about prolonging the life of its last nuclear reactor. And only a few years ago, they were hell-bent on closing them all down. So it's likely that a number of the existing nuclear facilities will avoid being closed down, that Germany will prevail upon its utilities to keep them open, having already told them that they have to close them down. And there'll have to be some kind of monetary compensation to compensate those utilities for the costs they've already incurred. But energy is going to become very central to every conversation going forward. Commodity prices are also going to be a very significant challenge. We're at a point right now where it looks likely that commodity prices are going to come lower because we have a real growth scare right now. And when there's supply inelasticity, it against an environment where demand is falling, well, you can't really then anticipate that prices are going to be surging higher. And we already have high prices into an environment where liquidity conditions are tightening. So that's going to make speculating more expensive. And it's quite likely we're going to have a correction in some of the commodity prices. But then they're also likely to reignite in terms of interest when liquidity conditions ease, and just about everything else will as well. But we've already had a decade of incredible technological change, and that has already been fully priced in. Commodities are still cheap relative to equities. Now, of course, equities are exceptionally overvalued at present, and we've definitely seen major corrections in the innovation sector, and they persist. But we could be potentially be looking at a regime change, and the extent to which commodities hold their big moves on the upside, despite the short-term risk of further downside, will be central to the secular bull market hypothesis. So everything comes under contagion selling pressure during a correction, and particularly as a correction intensifies. The best and the sectors that are most finely attuned to the new reality bounce first. And those that break out to new all-time highs first are those that are likely to represent the leaders in the new bull market phenomenon. There's still a lot of worry about climate change. There's a lot of regulation and money being poured into renewables, and that's likely to intensify. And we definitely saw clear efforts to support the carbon credits price last week. And carbon credits remain well bid, despite the volatility that we've had in the wider markets. Now, it doesn't mean that they can't come back down, but they're also likely to rebound strongly because they're government sponsored. So I suspect that as we move out of this period, what we're going to move into is a period of government-sponsored bull markets. We're going to see much greater control exerted over the kinds of investments that will be profitable, and that's likely to contribute to greater demand for commodities over the longer term, because there's going to be a reorientation of the global economy and the global energy sector, and most particularly, it's going to be in direct conflict with the interests of the Russia-China partnership. The clear, I think, attack on the dollar as the reserve currency is being met with the determination to appreciate the currency, raise rates, and create confidence in the dollar, despite the massive amount of debt outstanding. Just which country wins is obviously going to be something that takes a long time to figure out. And we're just at the beginning of this transition. It's likely that commodities are going to rally spectacularly when interest rates start to come back down and inflationary pressures are deemed to have peaked and have come back down. But we're just not there yet. And therefore, I think we have to anticipate that we're still in a corrective phase, that there will continue to be downward pressure on prices, but that we are drawing progressively closer to important lows where value plays will become much more apparent. And certainly there are interesting things happening in the accelerations lore we've seen in some of the energy sector, the utility plays, the telecommunications sector, where there are strong cash flows, high yields, but still downtrends. Chartered telecoms is one of those. Excuse me, it's Charter Communications. I am not typing this particularly well. But it's accelerating lower. It's come from 800 to 400. It's got reasonably impressive reliability in terms of its earnings, and it's at a 10% free cash flow yield relative to the market cap. Even if we were to take that relative to the enterprise value, it's still an impressive yield. So it's not like there aren't companies that are making money. There are plenty of companies that are making money, and many of the Fangman companies are still exceptionally impressive revenue producers. But it doesn't mean that they have to be the best performers in the market. And its growth has sustained their profit multiples. And those profit multiples may be in for some corrective or corrections. We're definitely seeing that in the prices. And there's no sign yet that it's over. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.